Les conférences du Collège de France.
Okay, well, welcome back to this third lecture. I'm really happy and honored to introduce Tony Hunter, who is here for this series of four lectures, and who today will be talking about histidine phosphorylation and the regulation of biological processes. Tony, the floor is yours. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, Hugh, for inviting me to give this series of lectures and to spend a whole month in Paris, which obviously is a wonderful place to be. I'll start, as I started the other two lectures, with a little personal history here, just to get the crowd going, as it were. So I began as a graduate student in the Department of Biochemistry in Cambridge in 1965, and here I am, just as I went into graduate school without a beard. Here's some evidence that I actually did experiments whilst I was a graduate student, eluting globin peptide spots from paper chromatogram. I got my PhD in 1969, and here I am, started growing my hair out because it was that time in the 1970s. And I don't know what I was typing, but I was more of an office worker than an experimentalist, obviously. And then in 1971, I went to the Salk Institute in La Jolla in California to do postdoctoral studies for 2 years. And in 1973, I returned to the UK to look for a job. And there was a major transition. Whilst I was in California, I grew a long beard. The story is that I grew it at the bottom of the Grand Canyon on a rafting trip and let my hair grow even further. Apparently, they didn't like my appearance because I didn't get a job in the UK. And so I went back to California, where they offered me a position at the Salk Institute in 1975, where I've been ever since. And I also showed these slides at the beginning of my other lectures, but it'll just catch you up to speed about the history of protein phosphorylation, which I would say is discovered in 1906 by Levine and Alsberg, who showed that there is phosphate covalently attached to vitellin, an egg protein. It took them another 25 years to show that what this phosphate was linked to, and in 1932 they showed that it was primarily linked to serine, and so vitellin contains phosphoserine. At the same time, they actually synthesized phosphothreonine, phosphoserine and phosphotyrosine to serve as markers because they thought that the phosphate would have to be in the form of a phosphate ester. And they actually synthesized phosphotyrosine reported its synthesis in 1933. The next important steps in the history are the discovery of enzymes that catalyze the phosphorylation of proteins using ATP. Eugene Kennedy's work in 1954, identifying a potential casein kinase, and then the seminal work of Ed Krebs and Eddie Fisher, who purified the enzyme that phosphorylates glycogen phosphorylase and activates it, phosphorylase kinase. The next phosphoramino acid to be identified was phosphohistidine in 1962, and I will tell you about that. And then finally, phosphotyrosine was identified in 1979-80 through our work, and I told that story in my first lecture, and I won't go through that again. So over the course of the three lectures so far, I've been surveying different types of post-translational modifications and their functions. Just to remind you then, of the 20 amino acids, 15 of them can be post-translationally modified by a chemical adduct. And I spent a lot of time talking about serine, threonine, and tyrosine phosphorylation, which are some of the most common post-translational modifications. But today I'm going to focus on histidine phosphorylation, which can be modified in several ways, actually: methylation, acetylation, and as well as phosphorylation. And I'm going to be talking about phosphorylation of histidine as a post-translational modification. So phosphorylation is a reversible modification, like many of the other PTMs, of which there are around 400. And these reversible modifications have a series of of enzymes that act on them. There are writer enzymes. In the case of phosphorylation, this is a protein kinase that utilizes the gamma phosphate of ATP to generate a phosphoprotein, phosphoserine, threonine, or tyrosine. And a second class of enzyme, the erasers, in this case protein phosphatases, that remove phosphate from the protein, reverting it back to its original state. So if you like, this is a state switch between dephospho and phospho. And then often for post-translational modifications, there are proteins with PTM-specific binding domains, such as the SH2 domain, which recognizes phosphotyrosine residues in proteins, and these are commonly known as reader proteins. And I talked a lot in my first lecture about the numbers of protein kinases and phosphatases that catalyze serine, threonine, and tyrosine phosphorylation, with over 500 kinases and around 200 protein phosphatases, and a large number of phosphobinding domains that recognize phosphorylated residues to transmit signals. And phosphorylation remains the most prevalent post-translational modification, particularly in multicellular eukaryotes like mammals. And as I said, there are many modular binding domains between 50 and 200 residues in size, globular domains usually that recognize a phosphorylated tyrosine like an SH2 domain or a FHA domain for phosphoserine, etc. Particularly important are domains that recognize modified lysine residues in chromatin to regulate transcription. And I also pointed out that post-translational modifications are a way of increasing proteome complexity. Mammals start out with around 20,000 coding genes, and through alternative splicing and starts and stops, one can generate maybe 100 proteoforms out of those genes, which is a large number, but perhaps not a large enough number for the complexity of a mammalian organism. But by modifying each of these with combinatorial use of post-translational modifications, in principle, you could generate a million protein states or proteoforms. And if you were interested in a nice discussion about this paper from Ebersold et al. in 2018 is quite interesting. So here are just some numbers to give you a sense of the complexity. The cell signaling technology Phosphocyte Plus database lists around 300,000 unique serine, threonine, and tyrosine phosphocytes, but there are large numbers of modification sites for other types, including ubiquitination, sumoylation, acetylation, and methylation. So a total of nearly 500,000 individual modification sites that can be used, as I discussed in my second lecture, combinatorially to regulate crosstalk between proteins or within a protein. However, in addition to serine, threonine, and tyrosine, which are the canonical or classical phosphorylations that we all know and love, they're heat-stable modifications. The half-life of phosphoserine in water, a pH 7, is about 100 years, so an incredibly stable chemical moiety. And they've been strongly implicated in several diseases, cancer, inflammation, immune responses, etc. However, what's less commonly appreciated is that there are six other amino acids that can be phosphorylated, the three basic amino acids, arginine, lysine, and histidine, cysteine, which forms a thiophosphoester, and aspartate and glutamate, which form mixed acid anhydrides. And I should have pointed out that arginine, lysine, and histidine all form phosphoramidates, phosphorus nitrogen bonds. So these are non-canonical phosphorylations. They've been little studied. They're all heat and acid labile, making them challenging to work on. And we know rather little about whether they play a role in diseases such as cancer. So we became interested in histidine phosphorylation many years ago now, as I'll tell you. And I'm going to talk about what we know about histidine phosphorylation and what our work has revealed. So what we're really trying to understand is whether histidine phosphorylation could act as a reversible modification in which there is a kinase that phosphorylates histidine, generating a phosphohistidine-containing protein, whether there are phosphatases that can remove that phosphate, and whether there might be phosphohistidine binding domains. So let me come back then to the history of histidine phosphorylation discovered in 1962 by Paul Boyer's group, who was working on mechanisms of oxidative phosphorylation and discovered that was a labile, chemically labile intermediate that was labeled in the presence of gamma P32 ATP. And he suggested this might be an intermediate in oxidative phosphorylation. So this was his paper in JBC in 1962. In 1964, he went on to show that this phosphohistidine was actually an enzyme intermediate in both the liver and E. coli succinate thiokinases, perhaps better known as succinyl-CoA synthase, which is a mitochondrial TCA cycle enzyme that generates ATP or GTP in a substrate-level phosphorylation step independent of electron transport. And this is his paper in BBRC in 1964, reporting that a liver succinate thiokinase contains phosphohistidine. So I became interested in histidine phosphorylation because of the chemical similarity between phosphotyrosine, which I'd worked on for several years, and phosphohistidine. And just to point this out, tyrosine, its phenolic ring, is phosphorylated on the 4-hydroxy position, creating a phosphate ester, which is acid and heat labile. Histidine has an imidazole ring, 5-membered ring with 2 nitrogens, and either nitrogen can be phosphorylated, the N1 position, forming 1 phosphohistidine, or the N3 position, forming N3 or 3 phosphohistidine. Both these then are phosphorus nitrogen bonds, and histidine is unique in being the only phosphoamino acid with 2 different isoforms that have different properties. Now, phosphoramidate linkages are both acid and heat labile, which makes them, as I said, difficult to study. But particularly, 3-phosphohistidine is sort of chemically similar to phosphotyrosine, and I'll return to that point again in a minute. So again, to come back to what we were interested in doing is to determine whether there are histidine kinases that can phosphorylate histidine on the 103 position and phosphohistidine phosphatases that can remove that phosphate, making this a reversible modification. So I summarized the history of a timeline of the history of histidine phosphorylation in this slide, which was in an article I wrote in Molecular Cell. So as I told you, phosphohistidine was discovered in 1962. An enzyme that phosphorylated histone H4 on histidine was reported in 1973. In 1971, phosphohistidine was reported to be the active site intermediate of ATP citrate lyase. And then importantly, and I'll discuss this a little more, enzymes in the bacterial 2-component signaling systems were shown to use a phosphohistidine intermediate, particularly KIA. And then nucleoside diphosphate kinases, or NMEs, were shown to have a 1-phosphohistidine intermediate. And the first phosphohistidine phosphatase was reported in 2002, PHPT1. And I won't take you through the rest of this history because I will be discussing individual examples. So I've sort of summarized that here in words. So histidine phosphorylation of proteins is well documented in bacterial 2-component systems. that are used for chemotaxis, osmosensing, and a way of responding to the bacterium's external environment. And in these cases, there's a receptor-like protein which becomes phosphorylated on histidine in response to this external signal, forming a phosphohistidine enzyme intermediate, and that phosphate's transferred onto an aspartate residue in a second protein that gives the signal output. But phosphohistidine is also found in mammalian systems, particularly as enzyme intermediates that I'll talk about. And the only reported histidine kinases that might phosphorylate proteins are these two, NME1 and NME2 proteins that I'll discuss. And we have at least three phosphohistidine phosphatases. Now, the NME family has 10 members. They're shown here. The first four are clearly active enzymes. They autophosphorylate on histidine, and they can act as nucleoside diphosphate kinases. That's probably also true of NME 5, 6, and 7, but we know less about NME 8, 9, and NME 10 is probably a pseudoenzyme because it's missing part of the catalytic domain. And these NMEs are actually probably partly redundant and are distributed in the cell in different places. NME 1, 2, and 3 can be in the nucleus or the cytoplasm. NME 3 and 4 in mitochondria, for instance. And their main housekeeping function is to rephosphorylate nucleoside diphosphates like GDP to reform GTP. Now, the NME proteins got their name from a discovery by Pat Steig, which I probably should have pointed out on the timeline, that levels of NME1 are reduced in metastatic cells. So NME stands for non-metastatic. Now, let me stress again the chemical instability of phosphohistidine, either the 1 or the 3 form. The free energy of hydrolysis of the phosphoramidate bond is very high compared to that of a phosphate monoester bond, and this is about as high as the anhydride bond in ATP. And so that's why the NMEs can reversibly phosphorylate nucleoside diphosphates. But here's some work from Tom Meir's group showing that in 1 molar HCl, which admittedly is not mild acid, at 49 degrees, the half-life of 3 phosphohistidine is 25 seconds, and the half-life of 1 phosphohistidine is 18 seconds. So these two isoforms of phosphohistidine begin to fall apart, even at pH 6, quite rapidly, depending a little on the sequence context in the protein. So I already introduced the bacterial two-component system. So in response to a stimulus, the receptor part of the system activates the histidine kinase to phosphorylate histidine in a receiver domain. And that phosphate is then transferred onto an aspartate residue. This is a phosphohistidine phosphoaspartate relay. This is commonly a transcription factor. And when phosphorylated, it activates transcription. And remember that in bacteria, the chromatin is right under the membrane. So here's some examples of these two component systems. Sometimes there is a transfer from phosphohistidine to phosphohistidine to phosphohistidine in this pyruvate system. And there's even a phosphocysteine here. In other cases, there's phosphohistidine to phosphoaspartate to phosphohistidine to phosphoaspartate, or just a single step. So a lot of phosphate transfers between histidine, aspartate, and even cysteine. And in these cases here, there is a cellular response. Now, in case you don't believe me that there is such a thing as phosphohistidine in proteins, there are structures, this very nice structure from Mel Simon's lab, of the key A enzyme, which is involved in chemotaxis, as the key name implies, shows in the receiver domain, there is a very nice 3-phosphohistidine molecule. Now, in mammalian cells, these two component systems have been lost. They are found one or two cases in simple eukaryotes, like yeast has a single two-component system. Bacteria have up to 100 two-component systems. It's their main way of sensing the environment. But in eukaryotes, G-protein coupled receptors and receptor tyrosine kinases and some receptor threonine kinases took over those jobs. But we have these two enzymes that can phosphorylate proteins on histidine. And we have three, at least, phosphohistidine phosphatases, PHPT1 I mentioned already, LHPP, phosphoglycerate mutase 5. It's a distant relative of the glycolytic enzyme. So here's the enzyme mechanism for the NMEs. They use ATP to form a 1-phosphohistidine intermediate. That phosphate can be transferred onto a nucleoside diphosphate or onto a protein. There are several enzymes in mammalian cells that use phosphohistidine intermediates. I've already told you about succinyl-CoA synthetase, phosphoglycerate mutase, the 7th step in glycolysis, uses a 3-phosphohistidine intermediate, ATP citrate lyase that I'll talk about again in a minute, generates acetyl-CoA in the cytoplasm, and a recent discovery, phospholipase D, which is a hydrolase, forms a phosphohistidine intermediate during hydrolysis. So again, here are some structures to convince you then that phosphohistidine can be formed in enzymes. Here's the structure of the NME1, 1-phosphohistidine intermediate. Clearly the phosphate is on the 1 position, the 3 position is occupied by this glutamate. And here is phosphoglycerate mutase. The phosphate is on the 3 position of histidine 11. And here's a very recent structure from Wilson and Nemesi of the 3-phosphohistidine intermediate in this lysosomal exonuclease. Now here's acetyl-CoA synthase. It has a structure actually very like succinyl-CoA synthase in which phosphate hydrolyzes succinyl-CoA in the cytoplasm. This forms succinyl phosphate over in this part of the enzyme. And then that phosphohistidine swings over to a GDP binding site or an ADP binding site, and the phosphate is used to phosphorylate GDP. So this whole arm swings over around 30 angstroms from one side to the other to transfer the phosphate, and succinyl-CoA synthase uses a very similar mechanism. So I can sort of summarize what we know about histidine kinases. This is this unknown histone H4 kinase. The NME1 and NME2 are histidine kinases and their substrates here. I'll talk about some of them. And then we have the bacterial two-component system histidine kinases. And for the phosphatases, we have PHPT1 and several substrates. It's been shown to dephosphorylate LHPP. And phosphoglycerate mutase 5, which can dephosphorylate NME1 and NME2. And I wanted to point out where the phosphorylation site in histone H4 is. It's in one of the two sites, actually. It's in the N-terminal tail, and you can see it here. It's histidine 18. Histidine 18 is conserved in every eukaryotic cell in histone H4. And it can be phosphorylated in yeast and in mammalian cells. It's obviously in a very interesting position between a lysine 16, which can be acetylated, and lysine 20, which can be methylated. And we think this is going to be involved in regulating histone modifications, but there's no direct evidence for that yet. And this sort of summarizes in a review that we have coming out in the International Journal of Molecular Sciences some of the targets for NME1 and NME2, particularly in these ion channels here, and in this GPCR system where the beta subunit of the G protein has a histidine that's phosphorylated. And I won't take you through these other examples here. But I will take you through one particular case which has been worked out quite well in terms of understanding how histidine phosphorylation might regulate a protein activity. And that's this potassium. Let me go back here. This calcium-activated potassium channel, KCA3.1, where histidine 358 in the tails, and this is a tetrameric channel like most potassium channels, the histidines, the four histidines in the four tails can be phosphorylated by NME2. Now, normally, this channel is held in an inactive state by a copper ion chelated by the four histidines in the tails. And that holds it in a closed state. Now, in T cells, when the T cell receptor is activated, there's a burst of intracellular calcium that binds to these resident calmodulin molecules, causing a conformational change that then forces the tails apart, releasing the copper ion and allowing those histidines to be phosphorylated, preventing copper binding again. So that now opens the channel and potassium can escape. And I'll show you what that does in just a second. So here's a little bit of the data that we helped Ed Skolnick's group develop with using our antibodies to show that when you knock out PGAM5, which is the phosphatase that's dephosphorylating NME2, that there's a strong increase in 3-phosphohistidine in the channel, KCA3.1. And at the same time, there's a strong increase in NME2 NDKB here. So this is the sort of evidence that we use to come to those conclusions that NME2-driven phosphorylation of the histidine 358 in the tail of this potassium channel leads to its activation and potassium release, which now allows, by ionic balance, more calcium to enter the cell. And I should point out that PGAM5 uses an active site histidine to attack the phosphohistidine bond in NME2, so it forms a transient 3P his intermediate that's then hydrolyzed to complete the reaction. So to summarize what we know about histidine phosphorylation in mammalian cells, we have examples of ion channels that are regulated through histidine phosphorylation, G protein copper receptor signaling is regulated. I will show you some evidence that spindle pole function may be regulated by histidine phosphorylation, and we have at least histone H4 is phosphorylated on histidine in the nucleus. And there are several proteins in mitochondria that are histidine phosphorylated, possibly by NME4 and NME3. So it was becoming clear even in the 1980s that histidine phosphorylation would be interesting to study, but there was no general way to study it globally. And we thought it might be possible to generate phosphohistidine antibodies by analogy with the phosphotyrosine antibodies that have become so useful in studying tyrosine phosphorylation. And so in 1989, we set out to do this, so now 30 years ago, nearly. And we used a phosphohistidine-containing bacterial protein to immunize rabbits and failed. And we actually decided at the time what we needed was stable analogs of phosphohistidine. But I'll just show you one piece of evidence, one reason for thinking that it would be possible to make phosphohistidine antibodies, which was that Ray Frackleton had developed some of the very first monoclonal antibodies against phosphotyrosine. And one of them, 2G8, turned out not only to recognize phosphotyrosine, but also recognize ACLY, the protein I told you has a phosphohistidine intermediate. And this, as I said, is structurally similar to phosphotyrosine. So the antibodies were being fooled by the phospholysine. So I persuaded a naive graduate student in 1989 to try and develop phosphohistidine antibodies. And here are some pages from his notebook from any student who's watching this. A very neat notebook. And so it started in December of 1989, oh, December 19th, I guess, 1989, where he used two rabbits called Patty and Helen and took some pre-immune serum and then began to immunize them with this phosphoenzyme 3 of bacteria that I showed you actually in an earlier slide contains phosphohistidine. It's relatively stable, and it's from this sugar transfer system. And so in order to test whether we got antibodies, we needed some phosphohistidine-containing proteins. And so he made some chemically phosphorylated polyhistidine, which you could buy. And he also used two enzymes, as you'll see, to test his potential antibodies. So that's what's written here. So what he tested by ELISA were enzyme 3 itself, the immunogen, phosphoglycerate mutase, phosphorylated 3-phosphohistidine, and polyphosphohistidine, which is also 3-phosphohistidine. And his conclusion was that he couldn't find any evidence for antibodies, and that's what it says here. No evidence for anti-P, his wah. And so at that point, he gave up and sensibly enough switched to studying the Src tyrosine kinase. So again, we needed non-hydrolyzable analogs. Now, over the years, actually a number of stable analogs of phosphohistidine have been made by a number of groups. I'm going to talk about these two analogs, one phosphoryl triazolyl alanine called 1-PTZA, and 3-phosphoryl triazolyl alanine called 3-PTZA. And I'll tell you a little bit more about them. But there are several other ones. Several of these have been used to generate phosphoantibodies, either just coupled to a hapten carrier or as part of a peptide. Some of them work, but in many cases, they generate phosphotyrosine antibodies, which was obviously not ideal. So we started working on phosphohistidine antibodies again when this paper from Tom Muir's group came out in 2010. And they developed these simple click chemistry syntheses of 3 and 1 phosphoryl triazolyl alanine. So this is my one chemistry slide, and I don't understand this, but anyway, you either use copper or ruthenium and you get either this should be 1 and the 3 analogs, right? So they use the 3-PTZA analog built into a peptide to raise antibodies against the known site in histone H4, and you can see they can actually detect phosphohistidine in H4 when they chemically phosphorylate H4, recombinant H4. They could not detect the phosphohistidine in H4 from cells, however, and these antibodies also cross-reacted with phosphotyrosine. So, but this stimulated us to begin to think about using these two analogs. And we decided to incorporate them into degenerate peptides containing alanine and glycine, which are not immunogenic, with the goal of generating sequence-independent antibodies. So this is the design of the experiment. Jacques Marget and his group at Sanofi in Tucson built these peptides where the TZA analog was in the middle and there were 4 or 5 residues on either side that were either alanine or glycine randomly. And this is the bookkeeping here, and then these peptides had an N-terminal cysteine, that was used to couple the peptides to KLH and to immunize rabbits. And I won't take you through this because it was published quite some time ago now, but we generated polyclonal antibodies that were selective either for the 3 or 1 TZA analog, and also for 1 or 3 phosphohistidine. And we went on to generate monoclonal antibodies from the spleen cells of these rabbits. And so we generated rabbit monoclonal antibodies. And we used them for blotting initially, just to establish or validate them. Now, I told you that phosphohistidine is heat labile. And so if you boil your SDS samples in sample buffer, you lose the phosphohistidine. But luckily, it turns out you don't need to boil your SDS gel samples in order to get saturation of SDS. So in this case, we have a lysate of PANC1, pancreatic tumor cells, where half the sample was boiled and the other half was left on ice and ran the samples out. So this is always our control. We heat the samples to see if the signal we get is lost, which it should be if it's phosphohistidine. So the main signal we see with one of the 1-phosphohistidine antibodies is NME1 and NME2. So they're obviously highly active in these cells. There are some other bands that go away as well, though. With 2 of our 3-phosphohistidine antibodies, we see a lot of proteins in an E. coli lysate that go away with heating. Some are relatively stable, and we know these phosphohistidines for some reason are more stable. And also in 293 cells, a lot of bands that come up that go away. So we can use these antibodies for immunoblotting, for immunofluorescent staining, which I'll show you, for immunohistochemistry, which I'll show you, and for affinity enrichment of phosphohistidine proteins and peptides. Now, to try and understand how these antibodies have absolute specificity for the 1 and 3 phosphohistidines, we've solved the crystal structures together with Ian Wilson's group at Scripps of 2 of our 1-phis antibodies, or Fab fragments of the antibodies, and 3-phis. I'm not going to take you through the structures. These were published in PNAS 3 years ago now. But here are structures of 2 of our 1-phis antibodies. You can see they have a positively charged surface here to sort of attract in the phosphate group. And you can see that the phosphate on the peptide, which is shown here, this is the red phosphate, is coordinated by particularly this arginine here. And there are no contacts with the side chains of the peptide. So this suggests this will be relatively sequence independent. So this is the key arginine. It's in the CDRH3 loop, and it forms a salt bridge. And this feature is shared with the FMN-linked oxidoreductase phosphate binding superfamily, and also phosphotyrosine binding by the SH2 and PTB domains. Here are 3 3-phis antibodies bound to the phospho-TZA peptides, again, positively charged pocket to bring in the phosphate. And in this case, and I'll just show you SC44-8, there is a glycine XX glycine motif that is involved in phosphate binding that is loosely similar to the P-loop or Walker A motifs in which bind NTPs. And here's a sort of a blow-up of that. Again, no contacts with the side chains. We've gone on, and I'm not going to take you through this, to engineer one of these antibodies, the SC44 antibody, together with Dev Sidhu's lab, particularly Greg Martin and his lab, to try and improve the affinity of the antibodies using phage display that Sidhu's lab uses routinely. And after a lot of problems with getting a phage display scaffold that would work, and we ultimately made 20 different amino acid changes, we now have an antibody that has a tenfold higher affinity than the parental antibody. And we have structures of this antibody bound to a 3-PTZA peptide and a naturally phosphorylated 3-PHIS peptide. And you can see the structures of the binding pocket are very similar. And we have carried out some quantum mechanical modeling to determine how these two structures differ. And it appears that there is this contact, the perpendicular pi-pi contact with this triazolyl ring is the key to the difference in the binding. Now, we can use the antibodies for immunofluorescent staining. Here is staining of HeLa cells with a 1P His antibody and DAPI. You can see very strong staining around the vacuole, which is interesting and suggests a lot of 1P His in that region, possibly because there's a lot of NME1 and 2 there. Sorry, I should have shown you this region was blown up here, maybe the phagosome or vacuole. And we also did experiments, particularly with Anna Zagorska, showing that macrophages that have engulfed extram bead here have, and you can see by lyso tracker, have a high signal of 1P His. So something interesting is going on around these vacuolar phagosome structures. If we stain with 3P His antibodies, we see nuclear speckles, could be histone H4, could be something else. Some speckles in the cytoplasm where you can't really see because the light is so bright. But particularly interesting, in cells entering prophase, you see these two dots, which turn out to be the centrosomes. We have staining to show that. And in anaphase, when the centrosomes split to become the spindle poles, you can see very strong staining of the spindle poles and other proteins in this mitotic cell. And if you look at this cell in telophase, you can see three dots, which correspond to the two spindle poles and the midbody. So this is obviously a very interesting staining pattern. So what are those proteins? Well, we've tried to find out by doing enrichment with immobilized antibodies linked to protein A beads. And basically, we've lysed cells at pH 10 in 6 molar urea to stabilize phosphohistidine and break up any complexes. And then done this with a SILAC protocol with a control where we've simply heat treated the lysate and put it through the same protocol where we reduce by dilution the urea to 1 molar and reduce the pH, bind to the antibodies, dilute at high pH, pH 11, lyophilize the eluate, and then carry out tryptic digestion and LC-MS-MS under positive ion mode. In other words, the cells, the peptides are going to be positively charged. We got about 800 proteins that were enriched twofold by either 1 or 3P His antibodies. GO biological process analysis showed that about 400 of them were predicted to be involved in RNA-related processes. You can see the types of process here. About 100 in cell cycle, consistent with our staining pattern and proteins we hope to enrich, histone H4 and these three enzymes. So we think that the system is working. We can't actually show these proteins contain phosphohistidine for that. We need to identify sites of phosphorylation, so we've used the same beads to pull out phosphohistidine peptides from tryptic digest, which are made at pH 8, so stabilizing pHis. And this is work done by Kevin Adam, French postdoc in the lab, who's now back here in Paris and has just started a small biotech company called Rosetta Omics. And this is his analysis of the peptides that were enriched from HeLa cells, and these were potential phosphohistidine, lysine, and arginine because we seem to enrich some other types of phosphopeptide. And here's one of those potential phosphorylation sites, histidine 297, and where it would map in the LCK tyrosine kinase. So whether this is real, we still don't know, but it could be an interesting regulatory site. So here's a little summary of that with a sequence pileup, a logo motif showing no obvious sequence identity. sequence preference, rather, lots of leucines and arginines and lysines. We don't know whether this is because these stabilize the phosphopeptide or because they are a true preference. We did find one peptide we expected. This is phosphoglycerate mutase, and here are some of these other sites I had in the list on the last slide. And here are two new sites that we have found upon reanalysis together with a lab in Seattle, Ron Moritz's lab, which we're now carrying out further analysis by mutating the site of histidine phosphorylation to look for functional changes. So how abundant then is histidine phosphorylation or phosphohistidine in mammalian cells? We found around 800 proteins. Claire Ayers at the University of Liverpool has used another method for enriching acid labile peptides, and I found a few hundred p-his, p-arg, p-lice, p-as, p-leucites in HeLa cells. Other groups have also identified significant numbers of phosphohistidine peptides using other enrichment methods. And Richard Muyumo's group has used P31 NMR analysis on a protein lysate to try and estimate the level of phosphohistidine in which you can identify a phosphate ester linkage, beta hydroxy linkage in phosphoserine and threonine as this peak. And this is the peak for 3-phosphohistidine, which you can verify using synthetic 3-phosphohistidine. And their quantitative analysis, which I think is perhaps a little dubious here, suggests that 3-phosphohistidine might be a third as common as as phosphoserine and phosphothreonine, which I think will be amazing if true. But there clearly is, you can detect 3-phosphohistidine in cell lysates at least. So the hidden phosphoproteome, as we've been calling these unusual non-canonical phosphorylated amino acids, could be large. But a recent paper from Simone Lemire's group has cast some doubt on this, and if anyone wants to read why she thinks we got it wrong, you can look at this paper here. I'm not entirely convinced by her results either, so it's still an open question. As are many other things about histidine phosphorylation. So what sort of functions might be regulated? Cell cycle, RNA processing, translation. We've not made much progress on this. So how big is this phosphohistidine proteome? Maybe a few hundred. Are there other histidine kinases and phosphatases? Is there selective phosphorylation at the 1 or 3 position? We think it's mostly going to be at the 3 position. Are all the sites that are identified functionally relevant? The same argument is true for serine and threonine and tyrosine phosphorylation. Maybe sites that we identify are not really functionally relevant. How would phosphohistidine signals be decoded? Are there phosphohistidine binding domains, like SH2 domains? And then how might histidine phosphorylation regulate protein function? Well, it could inhibit metal ion binding. I already showed you an example of that. It might regulate ring domain E3 ligase activity, and I'll show you why in just a second, or it could be just simply a very large charge change which goes from +1 to -2 when histidine is phosphorylated. Now, the idea about ring fingers is that ring domains, which are part of E3 ubiquitin ligases that I discussed last time, is that one of the two zinc binding sites in the ring domain is an H1C3 site. Oh, I see my ring has shifted here. Anyway, so here's that histidine. And the 3-phosphate is sticking out of the structure. And if you now look at the structure of RNF4, which I talked about last time, a ring domain E3 ligase, bound to the UBC conjugating enzyme with a ubiquitin attached from the work of, I should have put the reference up here, from Ron Hayes' group, a phosphate on that histidine would have a steric clash with the ubiquitin and might inhibit activity. And we have some very preliminary evidence for MUL1 from Zifan Wang's lab suggesting that might be the case. So I think this is an interesting possibility. So in the last 10 minutes, let me just talk about what we've done with our antibodies to study the possible role of histidine phosphorylation in cancer. And I'll start with some published work we did in collaboration with my Cole's group in Basel, who had developed a mouse model of hepatocellular carcinoma by conditionally knocking out the P10 phosphatase that acts on PI3 kinase products, the three phosphoinositides, and TSC1, which is an activator of mTORC1, which leads to activation of the mTORC1 complex and the loss of P10 leads to activation of mTORC2. So his model is pretty aggressive. The CRE is driven by the BSA promoter, and within 20 weeks you see large numbers of focal tumors, and the animal dies shortly thereafter. And they did proteomic analysis on these tumors and found, looking for upregulated protein kinases and downregulated phosphatases, and found increased levels of the NME1 and NME2 histidine kinases and decreased levels of the LHPP phosphohistidine phosphatase. And so we collaborated with them using our antibodies to look at phosphohistidine levels in these samples. And here you can see that in tumors compared to control liver, each with a heated control, there was an elevation in three phosphohistidine signals and also in the NME1 phosphohistidine signal. So about a 2 to 3-fold increase in both signals. So that led them to try expressing LHPP in the liver by using an AAV vector injected into the tail vein, where it goes primarily into the liver. And they found that this significantly decreased the number and size of tumors in these double knockout mice, shown here. And by staining, this was done by Sravanth Hindupur, sections from the liver tumors, you can see high levels of three phosphohistidine signals that go away on heating the slides to 60 degrees before staining them. And so there does appear to be increased three phosphohistidine in the tumor samples, and using immobilized antibodies to pull out phosphohistidine proteins like I showed you before. Sravanth Hindupur came up with a series of proteins that were enriched, and particularly ACLY, which, as I told you, has a phosphohistidine intermediate. Now, importantly, they were able to show that there's elevated 3-phosphohistidine in human tumor samples compared to normal liver with the heated controls. And this led them to conclude then that the LHPP phosphohistidine phosphatase is acting as a liver tumor suppressor. And this raises the possibility that one might be able to target histidine phosphorylation in treatment of hepatocellular carcinoma. Now, in pediatric neuroblastoma, the aggressive forms have focal amplification of NME1 and NME2, and patients with tumors with high NME1 RNA levels have a very poor prognosis. So this locus is on chromosome 17q, which, as I said, is focally amplified. And these and cells from patients of this sort, SHBE2, have very high levels of phosphohistidine here by immunoblotting. Here's the boiling control. And very high levels of phospho-NME1 and NME2, as you would expect, since the protein levels are elevated. If one knocks out with shRNA, NME1, this actually, interestingly, accelerates wound healing of these cells in work we did together with Pete Sage's group at UCSD. And Kevin Adam and now Margot Sala, another French postdoc, has been working on this system to try and identify phosphohistidine-containing proteins that are elevated in these tumors that might be functionally relevant in their, particularly in their invasive phenotype. And Margot is focusing on these two proteins, the prohibitins, which have been reported to have roles in cell invasion. Interestingly, one of the two prohibitin genes is localized in the focal amplicon. Now, these proteins have an important role in mitochondria, but they can also be found in the cytoplasm. And Margot has shown by staining these neuroblastoma cells that one can detect co-localization of PHB1 and NME1 at the plasma membrane. You can see these yellow co-staining here in what may be invadosome structures. And she's also shown that NME1 and particularly phospho-NME1 and 2 can be co-precipitated when exogenously expressed V5 tagged PHB is stably expressed in these cells. So there's an interesting connection between this prohibitin and NME1 and NME2 that we're following up on. Now, I told you that in liver cancer, LHPP levels are low, whereas in breast cancer work from Jeffrey Reina in collaboration with Kay Jung, the opposite appears to be true, and there are certainly other cases where proteins are up in one type of cancer and down in another type. And you can see here staining primary human triple-negative breast cancer tissue, there are high levels of LHPP, and that can also be seen here by immunoblotting. So is it LHPP playing a role? Well, Jeffrey created knockout cells of MDA, MB231, triple-negative breast cancer cells. Found these cells show decreased scratch, wound, migration, and transwell invasion here, quantified. And perhaps most interestingly, the loss of LHPP severely delayed flank tumor growth in NOD-SCID mice and increase their survival. And strikingly, the loss of LHPP led to an almost complete lack of lung metastasis here. So it appears then that LHPP is playing a driver role in this particular cancer, and obviously we need to work out whether that's through its ability to dephosphorylate phosphohistidine. And then finally, in work on pancreatic cancer, which I'll be discussing in more detail next time, we found that phospho-ACLY levels are increased strongly in these tumors. Work from K.D. Welland's group has shown that if you knock out ACLY, which I told you through this mechanism here, forming citral phosphate in this case instead of succinyl phosphate, it generates cytoplasmic acetyl-CoA, which is used for de novo lipogenesis, but it's also important, as she showed, for histone acetylation and regulation of gene expression. And so she concluded then that pancreatic tumors are addicted to acetyl-CoA. So Natalie Lutala in the lab looked at tissue samples from the KPC mouse model of pancreatic cancer by blotting with this SC44 antibody, which is very good at detecting phospho-ACLY, and found very high levels of phospho-ACLY in the tumor tissue. And she developed a tyramide signal amplification protocol where the samples, the sections, are first stained with a 3P His antibody, and then that signal is captured by this system which deposits Psi-5 in the vicinity of the antibody, and then you can use antigen retrieval heating to stain for other antigens. And so she could co-stain with 3 phosphohistidine antibodies and, in this case, cytokeratin 19 to mark the tumor cells. And interestingly, as you'll see here in this co-stain, this overlap, that a lot of the signal, 3P His signal, is not in the tumor cells, but rather in stromal cells. And I'm afraid the colors are flipped here, But it appears that a lot of the signal is in the CD45 positive immune cells, which infiltrate this tumor, as I'll show you next time. And so we've been specifically looking at the CD45 cells for the role of ACLY. And using sorted cells from the KPC tumors, either CD45 positive, cytokeratin 19 positive, or podoplanin positive fibroblasts, it's pretty clear that it is the immune cells, and in particular, it's the macrophages, myeloid cells rather, which have very high levels of phospho-ACLY and actually a distinct ATK isoform that we're working on now. So currently then, we are conditionally knocking out ACLY in this tumor model to see what function it might play. So let me finish then by just concluding that, as I showed in my first lecture, tyrosine kinase inhibitors have become a major new class of cancer drug, with over 75 approved for clinical use in cancer and inflammatory diseases. And in the long run, what we hope is that we may be able to develop small molecule inhibitors either of the histidine kinases or of some target downstream of the histidine kinases, such as ACLY, that might be useful in treating cancers like hepatocellular carcinoma and neuroblastoma. So I'll start by thanking the people who did the work. Steve Foos was the brave postdoc who took on this project of making these antibodies without knowing whether it was possible. He had help from many people in the lab whose names I have told you as we go along, the chemists who made the antigens, funding from the NCI, and help in a number of the model systems and the structural work and mass spec work. So I'll just remind you then that my last lecture in this series will be on May 27th, and I'll be telling you about new insights into intracellular crosstalk in different cell populations in pancreatic tumors that can be translated into the clinic. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.